I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Iraqi politicians are hoping that their business will replace that of Iraqi car bombers in the news. The recently elected National Assembly is due to meet later this week, though the backroom maneuvering for coalition position continues. It seems the Kurds from the north and the Shia from the south are close to some kind of working arrangement. However, the work of the insurgents continues as well. Last week was a particularly awful one, with dozens of civilians killed at funerals and at mosques, and more policemen assassinated as well. This hour, we'll get the latest from Baghdad with the LA Times' Alyssa Rubin, and then we'll have Jackie Spinner with us. Jackie's a correspondent with the Washington Post. She has spent most of the last 9 months in Iraq. She was embedded with the U.S. military in Fallujah. She's seen much of the country in the past year's time, and she's seen it change. We'd like to have you join our conversation this hour. Tell us if you think you're getting the story you want from Iraq. We'll talk with Jackie about how you cover such a dangerous story and the new reliance on Iraqi journalists. Can their work give us a new window in on how Iraqis are feeling? We welcome your questions for Jackie Spinner. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start, though, with the latest from Iraq. Alyssa Rubin is in Baghdad. She's one of the LA Times Baghdad bureau chiefs. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, how are you?
Well, more to the point, how are you?
Just fine.
What's the latest on the politics there? Is there going to be a coalition government this week?
Well, I rather think we won't see a government formed this week. It's I guess there's certainly still a chance of it, but basically expectations have been lowered by all the people in the negotiations. Mr. Joffrey, who's the person that was named by the United Iraqi Alliance, the majority Shiite list that took the most votes, said in told a group of reporters that it might not be for another week or two. So I think they're trying to lower any expectations that there will be a government and a deal this week. But the National Assembly is slated to meet on Wednesday, and I think everyone thinks that will go forward. It may be a largely ceremonial meeting, but it will at least get everyone together, and presumably people will be talking a lot about the government and forming the government.
Alyssa, after the elections at the end of January, there was a lot of talk in Iraq, in Baghdad in particular, about the country getting its own sort of hands on its own political levers. I'm wondering, in anticipation of this week's meeting of the National Assembly, are people in Baghdad, are Iraqis themselves interested, paying attention to what's happening politically?
Well, I think they're rather puzzled right now. It's a very confusing situation. There's not a lot being said publicly, so a lot of people that I've talked to just say they don't really understand what's going on. They don't understand why the government hasn't been formed, and they sort of suspect the worst. I think we have to put this in some perspective, that in the past, Saddam Hussein there would be elections held. People would vote on, 99.9% of everyone voted yes, that they wanted Saddam to come back, and then the government would continue functioning. So there was no sense of what it might take to form a government. So I think people are feeling confused by this period of negotiation and flux. Now, there's also the chance that it's reaching a real stalemate where they're having trouble making a deal, and I think we're not entirely clear whether that's the case or whether this is sort of normal sort of positioning and jockeying. But I think it's probably a bit of both, a bit of stalemate and a bit of just doing it for the first time.
And how is work, Alyssa? How is it just getting around Baghdad, interviewing the people who you need to interview?
Well, I think it's not too bad. I mean, you have to be careful how you travel and where you travel, and also I think it's not so safe to go out in the evenings. There's a fair amount of crime in addition to whatever targeted or more political episodes or incidents there might be. So it's definitely a period when you have to be cautious, but I wouldn't say it's one of the worst periods. There have been times when we've had mortars and rockets and explosions sort of all day long, and the past few days have not been like that. But as I'm sure you'll hear from Jackie Spinner in a few minutes, it changes all the time, and that's one of the very difficult things is that you sort of adjust to whatever the circumstances are, and as you've adjusted, they're about to change, and you're either being so abundantly cautious that you're not able to report the way you want to, or you're taking risks that you didn't realize you were taking.
You mentioned Jackie Spinner is going to be our guest for the hour, and she's actually standing by at the studios of WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Jackie, you should jump in here because I think you and Alyssa know each other, do you not?
Yes, we work together in Baghdad. I know Alyssa.
You're welcome to use this program to catch up if you want, then.
Well, just stay safe.
I will.
Alyssa.
Good weather for once.
Oh, yeah, things are starting to warm up there now, aren't they?
Actually, it's been quite chilly and clear and blue skies and completely unlike any other time I've been in Baghdad.
Well, enjoy it because soon it will be warm.
Thank you.
That's Alyssa Rubin there, one of Baghdad's bureau chiefs for the Los Angeles Times. And Jackie, it's so nice of you to agree to spend an hour with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been back in the country, what now, 9-10 days? Not much more than that?
No, not much more. A few days shy of 2 weeks.
Are you still decompressing then?
I'm still decompressing. I'm mostly catching up on my sleep.
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of that. When you're listening to Alyssa talking about this confusion, you know, what's going to happen with the political picture there, this is something that you dealt with very directly yourself. Take us one step further in that. The sense of confusion that Alyssa describes, people wondering what it is that their politicians might do for them, is that because they've never, most people have had no experience with representative politics?
I think that's fair. And this whole process is confusing to people. I mean, imagine back, you know, when our presidential election was up in the air and how confusing that was for Americans. And we were used to a democratic process and that waiting that we went through back then. And then put that in Iraq where people haven't seen democratic elections and they don't know what this looks like. And they thought that you go to the polls, you elect somebody and you have a new government. And it's been weeks now, months since the election, and there's still no government, and people don't understand why that is.
I'm wondering if the enthusiasm that came right after the election as a result of that might slip away, might be hard to sort of regain, because I'm not sure whether or not you were doing these stories, but I remember a whole flurry of stories after the elections about Iraqis saying, hey, now we may finally be in charge of our own affairs.
Right. I mean, I think there is a very narrow window for people to remain engaged in the process. But one of the things that was really fascinating for me to watch is just the level of dialogue about the political process. I mean, people were talking about the election. They were talking about the jockeying that was taking place. They were talking about the horse trading, and people had opinions. And that was a really fascinating change over you know, since Saddam, that people were actually that engaged in the political process.
I'm wondering what was going through your mind just in the past 10 days or so when you saw all the reaction to the shooting at the Italian journalist's car. That's a piece of road I'm sure that you've traveled more than once, and you kind of would see both sides of that story.
You definitely see both sides. I'll tell you about an experience I had in December. I had spent about 6 weeks in Fallujah covering that battle, and I went directly there to another embed in Bakuba, which is also in the Sunni Triangle and an area that is still very volatile. And one morning, I went out on a patrol with a group of from the 1st Infantry Division, and I didn't really know what we were doing. I just got in the back of the Humvee, and we went out to a road. And the soldiers jumped out and they strung some Constantine wire across the road and put up a sign. And I said, guys, what are we doing? And they said, well, we're setting up a vehicle checkpoint. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, we're going to try to catch suicide bombers. And I said, well, how are we going to do that? And they said, well, we basically wait until they come and try to blow us up. So, you know, these vehicle checkpoints for these soldiers are very, very dangerous, vulnerable points for them. And it's really scary to be out there just waiting for somebody to, as the soldier said, come and try to blow you up.
And so when we listen to the story of Giuliana from Italy. I'm wondering, were you thinking maybe that all the criticism of the Americans who shot might have been misplaced, that there wasn't the same case being made for how dangerous it is for the Americans on the other side?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those situations. I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what the circumstances are. And so I certainly don't want to cast judgment. There was a life lost. And that's, you know, I don't want to be in the position of defending, you know, anybody without knowing exactly what happened. All I can offer as commentary is these checkpoints are very dangerous. They're dangerous for soldiers. They're dangerous for civilians. That airport road is one of the most dangerous stretches in Iraq. You know, every time that I was on it, my heart was always racing, you know, sort of waiting in anticipation for something bad to happen. And I can only imagine if you're in a soldier and you're just standing out there very vulnerable, you know, with the threat of car bombs or mortars, you know, what would be going through their mind with a car racing up to the checkpoint.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Jackie Spinner is with us for the hour. It's a chance for you to bring your questions to the table about the stories that you're seeing from Iraq, the stories that you're wondering about in Baghdad and in the area surrounding that. Jackie was one of the American reporters who was embedded with the U.S. military in Fallujah and has had a chance in the months since then to reflect on how that has changed the relationship between the Americans and the Sunni in that particularly dangerous part of the country. But we're also talking about political change and a shift towards the Iraqis taking responsibility for their own affairs. Quite a range here. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. The inside story of covering the story in Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Jackie Spinner is with us. She's a correspondent with The Washington Post, just back from 9 months' work in Iraq, joining us from the studios of WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us at some point in the program. Let me ask you, Jackie, if we go back 9 months to when you first got to Iraq and you kind of look back over that period of time, my own recollection is that it was pretty tough for journalists when you got there in terms of beheadings and the threat of kidnapping. Did it get worse?
It definitely got worse. I mean, I had the unfortunate experience in Iraq of being there only at a time when it was dangerous and you didn't have free movement. You know, you were there and you know that right after the fall of Saddam, journalists roamed pretty freely throughout Iraq.
Yeah.
And we're doing a lot of street reporting, and by the time I got there in May, we were doing some street reporting, and we were still getting out. But it was really starting to get pretty bad about that time period, and it just got worse. But as Alyssa said, it fluctuates. It's a wave. It's not a progressive decline, and now it's worse than it's ever been. In fact, it's a little better right now than it was in the October-November timeframe.
You wrote or had a kind of exchange with readers of the Washington Post in a kind of web exchange which I read. And one of the things that jumped out for me in that, Jackie, was your kind of nod to the work that is now being done for agencies like the Washington Post by Iraqi journalists. Is that something that's relatively new?
Yeah, you know, when we can't get out and do our own reporting, we have to rely on the eyes and ears of our Iraqi staff. And these are individuals who we have trained to be journalists, and we consider them special correspondents. We elevate them beyond the stringer translator status to special correspondents. And, you know, if there's a city that I can't go to, if there's a car bombing that's way too dangerous for me to go to, we send these correspondents out, and they do the work of the Washington Post and bring it back to us, and we collaborate.
Now, tell me, if you were to send one of these people to a hospital scene or a place where a mosque had been bombed, do they identify themselves as working for the Washington Post? The reason I'm asking, I'm just wondering if that would mean that it could be just as dangerous for them as it would be for you if they identify themselves as being with an American news agency.
No, they don't. They always identify themselves as journalists, but they rarely mention that they work for a Western media organization. And I'm sure that some of our practices in Iraq will be debated in journalism schools because we've had to get very creative about how we identify ourselves and how we actually conduct our journalism. But no, they rarely say exactly who they are from. We encourage them not to lie, and we don't ever want them to misrepresent themselves as we don't misrepresent ourselves, but they definitely don't say they're working for a Western news organization.
Tell me what you think about the kind of work that they're doing. I mean, is this the next generation of you know, the Iraqi journalistic class?
You know, it's for me one of the most moving things has been watching the development of the Iraqi press over the last year. You know, there's a whole new generation of journalists that are working in Iraq as free journalists, and just watching them develop and seeing them grow at press conferences and the kinds of questions they ask and, you know, what they do with the material. Are people we believe are going to be, you know, if they continue in journalism, and not all of them, you know, were journalists to begin with. I mean, we have two individuals who were we picked up straight out of college. We have one of our best translators is an Iraqi Airways pilot. We have, you know, all sorts of people that we have trained as journalists, and this is somewhat of a second career for many of them. But they're extraordinary, and they're talented, and they're brave. And as you said, I think we are creating a new class of journalists in Iraq.
I wonder if you had any discussion at the Bureau there about naming them in the stories, because I see you do give them, you know, byline credit or thanks at the end of a story. And I'm wondering, wow, I wonder if, you know, even in a web-wise world, that could put them at risk.
It could, and we absolutely give them the option of whether or not we use their name. We never use the name of our stringer in Fallujah. For security reasons, his name never appears in the paper, and he has agreed to that because he doesn't want his life to be any more at risk than it already is. But it is a concern, and we're constantly vetting, you know, this issue and what danger we're putting the staff at. You know, many of them don't even, their families don't even know mm-hmm. where they work, because it's that dangerous for them to be working for a Western news organization.
Well, I think you're right, Jackie. I can hear new seminars in journalism schools puzzling over this one. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Norfolk, Virginia for our first call. Richard's on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hi. That's something that's been worrying me some time as to, do the Iraqi people expect the insurgents to cease their attacks once the Iraqi militia has been built up to a large extent, or will they think that the same thing will happen to the militia as was happening to our highly trained troops? Do they depend upon defections sufficiently from the insurgents to provide intelligence to wipe the insurgents out? Or how do they feel about it? Do they expect an oncoming civil war?
Go ahead, Jackie.
Well, that's a great question, and I think that, you know, in talking to the Iraqis that I've talked to, are definitely fearful of what will happen when the American troops and the coalition forces leave the country, and the question of how good and how well trained the new Iraqi forces is something that the new government is dealing with. I mean, they're certainly training these people up. They expect eventually, and there's no time frame for this, to hand over the security of the country to the new Iraqi forces. But I don't think anybody expects this insurgency to go away overnight. And they certainly don't expect that the new Iraqi forces right now are capable of fighting this insurgency.
I saw on the wires over the weekend, Jackie, a story from General Richard Myers, who's traveling in the area, saying now we're up to 142,000 Iraqis trained. But I'm wondering, do you see that evidence of that on the street? Are you seeing these people in any kind of an offensive position, or are they still a little back on their heels, wondering where the next car bomb's going to come from?
It depends. I mean, the different battalions that they have across the country, there are some that are definitely better than others. And there are, I've observed that there's a SWAT team in Hilla, and I've seen them out in action, and they are very well trained. And You know, they don't have the problems with defections, and this is a this is an elite group of Iraqi security forces, and I've also seen an Iraqi National Guard unit in Bukuba on at a checkpoint where we pulled up with the American military and we had to wake them up. So it's really mixed across the country as to, you know, how good these forces are.
Let's go back to Richard in Norfolk. Richard, are you asking because, like many people in the country, you're wondering when the Iraqi government is going to be able to manage its own military and police affairs and allow some of the American soldiers to come home? Is that where you're coming from on this?
It's just that the idea of a single person armed as they are in a suicide bomb, there seems to be no defense, really, against this. And I wonder if it's not going to take an immense number of troops guarding borders to guard against supplies coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And from the beginning of the war, the Americans said they did never have enough troops to guard from these storings of ammunition that all over the country, and from which the insurgents probably have been drawing a great deal of support and supplies. I wonder, ultimately, even around the world, it's not going to take a total global organization of all nations in order to stop this, because essentially there's no defense against a single bomber entering New York City.
Let's just leave it in Iraq for the time being, because it's Jackie's area of particular expertise. And one of the points, Richard, that you're talking about is one I'd like to hear Jackie on a little bit. And that is, Jackie, again, recent reporting here from people studying those Islamic websites, people looking at the websites and saying, oh, no, you know, we're still fine. We're still strong. Don't worry about us. And wondering if there wasn't in those a sort of a recruitment frenzy going on, that maybe there are signs of weakness. I don't know whether or not that gets discussed much. Are people, you know, looking at the insurgents' websites that closely and trying to figure out their strength?
Yeah, there's definitely an enormous intel operation that's going on in Iraq. And when I talk to the military commanders, when they talk about how they're going to beat this insurgency, they don't necessarily talk about it in terms of troop strength. They talk about it in terms of intelligence gathering. And that's really, from their perspective, how you stop these suicide bombers. And you shut down their network. You take away their weapons. You take away their ability to move weapons throughout the country. I mean, Fallujah is a good example of this. I mean, that city is probably one of the safest cities in Iraq right now, and you know, and it had been one of the most dangerous cities. It is completely occupied, however, both by American and Iraqi security forces. But it is safe, and there are few weapons left in the city. There are few insurgents left in the city, and it feels very comfortable.
We've got a caller from Boston, actually, who wanted to ask you a couple of questions about Fallujah. Keith, have we answered your questions already?
Well, I was just chuckling as you began introducing me. I think Fallujah is safe probably because it's been virtually leveled. I just came back from 14 days in Iraq with a Christian peacemaker team.
Where were you, Keith?
I spent my time actually in Kerbala. Half the group was in Kerbala and half our group stayed in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Quaker organization, so there was no proselytizing going on. And we met with this Muslim peacemaker team that was newly formed and, you know, really engaged in the activities of nonviolent conflict resolution. But I did have a couple of questions for the reporter about Fallujah, since she was embedded with the U.S. Army there.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if she was aware of the various kinds of weapons. There's allegations that both legal and illegal weapons were used during the siege of Fallujah, and also people who were trying to leave carrying white flags were either shot and or bombed during that siege.
Just a quick clarification, Keith, before we turn to Jackie. When you talk about illegal weapons, are you talking about the use of depleted
chemical
uranium
weapons.
Shells or what?
No, well, there are weapons that the United States Army uses that it considers to be legal, like depleted uranium, but other illegal things like various chemical weapons. And there's evidence that the UN is actually investigating. We met with the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, who's now in Amman, Jordan, because they had to evacuate. And he was pretty much aware of everything that we brought up regarding Fallujah.
Okay, Jackie, what do you know?
Well, I can tell you what I saw firsthand. And that is the U.S. military was using a substance called white phosphorus rounds. And one of the reactions that, and this is considered, I believe, a legal chemical weapon. One of the things that happens with white phosphorus is that when it reacts with the skin, if you put water on it, it causes a sort of melting reaction. And so we were hearing reports from the doctors in Fallujah that the military was using chemical weapons. And when we investigated further, the military acknowledged that this was the substance that they were using, and that was the reaction that people were having to the substance. I'm not a weapons expert, and I'm not even a military expert, so I can't tell you, exactly all the time, what I was seeing. But my personal, just firsthand account is only of seeing this sort of this white phosphorus. I didn't see any individuals being shot with white flags, but in the confusion of the battlefield, you can't rule that out.
Jackie, what is this white phosphorus? Is it fired as a shell which then explodes and releases the gas? Is it meant to disable people or kill them? Did you find out?
My understanding is it's sort of an illuminating thing, and it's fired. It's fired from artillery. Artillery mechanisms, mm-hmm. and it's been used for many, many years. It's certainly not a new chemical that just was invented for Fallujah or was just used in Fallujah for the first time.
Tell me though, it's just sort of on the theme of Keith's call here, how frustrating it is to be working on a story where you're own movement is so limited, and there are all these questions. I mean, we're watching now this past week and likely more reports released from the Abu Ghraib story about further instances of detainee abuse that weren't known. Questions like, Keith, about what kind of weapons are used. Is it frustrating when those parts of the stories are the ones that are hardest for you to get at when you're posted in such a place?
It is very frustrating. I mean, one of the things that, became more frustrating for me over time is just the inability for me to get out and see things for myself. And there are limitations that we are under. But, I think there's also a myth or a misunderstanding that, that all the journalists in Iraq or sort of holed up in the green zone, mm-hmm. and we're writing from our rooms and never seeing the country, and that's just simply not true. I mean, our travel is restricted, and we have to get creative about the ways that we get out and get the story. But I feel fairly confident that the Washington Post is getting the story. We're just having to do it differently, mm-hmm. than we have to do it in other places. And we are very reliant on the military to get to places like Fallujah and to Mosul and these areas where we can't just, what I would call freelance, we can't just drive in ourselves and poke around. And when you are embedded with the military, you are to some extent getting the story that the military wants you to see. And again, you have to be creative and you have to push them and, to get your questions answered and to get to see the things that you want to see.
Have you had any chance to go back to Fallujah since the time of the fighting in the fall?
Yes, I was just actually there last month. I went in with the Marines.
Okay, sorry,
yeah, and it was a completely different experience. When I went in November, I went in an armored vehicle. We were, we were in battle. We were constantly under fire. It was a very dangerous, very scary time to be with the military. The last time I went in, I rode in the back of a pickup truck. I don't even know if it was armored or not. We walked the streets, and I felt very comfortable and very safe. The soldiers were throwing candy to the children and getting a pretty nice reception from many of the residents, and it was a completely different experience. I wouldn't say that the city is absolutely leveled. There's a lot of battle damage in there, and it's going to take years and years to get it fixed up. But Fallujah was also, it wasn't a great place before the U.S. came in. It was a very neglected city.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Jackie Spinner is with us for the hour. She's a reporter for The Washington Post, just back from a 9-month posting in Iraq. Questions for you. Are you getting the stories that you want from Iraq, from Jackie, and from all the other Western reporters who are there? Your thoughts on the reliance on Iraqi journalists and the work that they're doing for Western agencies. And can the collective work of all the people give all of us a better feeling, a better window in on how Iraqis are feeling? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jackie Spinner, correspondent with The Washington Post, is with us, just back from a nine-month stint in Iraq, and here to talk with you and answer your questions about work there and what she learned about the country. I'm wondering, Jackie, just in terms of the feedback that you do get, whether it's The Washington Post or The New York Times or whoever, is it did you find that it didn't really matter what story that you were telling, there were people who, in this country, were accusing you of taking one side or taking the other side?
Yeah, I definitely found that. One of the things that was really stunning to me, and it shouldn't have been because I've been a reporter for 15 years and I'm used to getting beat up by readers no matter what you write, but I was really stunned at the level of hate that many of the people would express, over stories where they thought that we were being anti-military or anti-Iraqi, and it ran the spectrum. It was coming from all sides, and I mean, I would get emails from people saying, you know, I wish you died today instead of that Marine, and things like that. And there was a real disconnect, and from many of the people who are corresponding with me, it's almost as if they didn't think that we were human, you know, human beings there reporting on the story of Iraq.
What's your conclusion about where that comes from? Was it just because the war itself has become so political here, or is it that it's still such a sensitive story?
I think it's both. I think that, you know, many people believe that they're not getting the true story of Iraq. And people who have a particular connection to the military are very frustrated with the media for not reporting what they call the good story, the good things that the soldiers are doing. And, you know, they want to see us as reporters supporting the troops and writing stories that are supportive of the troops. And I think that's where a lot of that emotion is coming from.
Let's go to Ogdensburg, New York, for a call from Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Yes, I had a question for your guest today. I heard earlier that they were relying on Iraqi journalists for much of the details in the story. And I was wondering how Jackie felt about, the impact that the Iraqi journalists have on what she's reporting. How would you feel if during the Vietnam War we relied on Vietnamese to cover much of our story, you know? I was just wondering how she felt about that and whether it was, professional of her to do that.
Well, in the absence of relying on our Iraqi staff, we couldn't get the story. And these are people who are trained as Washington Post journalists. They're not Iraqi journalists. They're Washington Post journalists. And so we have trained them, and they know how to go out and get the story. They're not writing the stories. They're simply gathering the facts, and then we evaluate the reporting that they do. And they're quite good. I mean, I sent a translator out to find out how many people died in a car bombing one time, and she came back and I said, did you interview the people at the hospital? How many people died? And she said, no, I didn't talk to the doctor, but there were 9 people killed. And I said, well, how do you know if you didn't talk to the doctor? She said, I went into the morgue and I counted the bodies. So we have trained these people, and we feel very confident that it is as good in many cases as going out to the scene ourselves.
What do you think, Sean, as an either-or here?
Well, that sounds like a very good answer to me. I didn't know that they were being trained as much as they were, and especially that they had the background as they did. I feel much more better now.
Well, thanks for your call, 1-800-423-8255. Where are we going next? To Bluffton, South Carolina. Joe's with us. Hi, Joe.
Yeah. Hi. My question is, I've read a recent story about the Iraqi elections and how the food rationing was used as a tool to make sure that there was voter participation. And I was wondering if Jackie could address that.
Well, the ration cards, the rationing system is basically the way that people register to vote, and I'm using a term that we use here in the U.S. and it's not quite the way the process worked, but it was a way of accounting for people because every Iraqi is eligible for food rationing. There were instances where when people went to register with their local food rationer, that those people refused to register people because they were afraid. And, you know, this election was not perfect, and there was fraud in the election. How widespread it was, it's, you know, I don't think we know. But this was not, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this was a perfect election, but by all accounts, it seems it was fairly successful.
All right, Joe, thanks for that. 1-800-423-TALK to Providence, Rhode Island. Dave's on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a couple of questions. I recently went to a talk which was led by an Iraqi veteran against the war, and he said a lot of what's going on over there isn't portrayed in the media. And
such as what, Dave?
Well, he said, for instance, the soldiers were poorly equipped when they went over. They said sanitation conditions are awful for the civilian Iraqis over there. He was told by one of his officers that the Geneva Convention doesn't exist. I mean, he just went on and on about it. So I just wonder what she thought about some of those points.
Well, I think that the Washington Post and the other American media organizations have written many stories about how poorly equipped the soldiers were going over there. And we've covered the hearings in Congress over, you know, the armored vehicles and the flak jackets and that those sorts of equipment that the U.S. military had and whether or not they were adequate. The sanitation conditions in parts of the country are horrible. They were horrible before the war, and they're still horrible. And much of our reconstruction money that's being spent in Iraq is going to improve sanitation conditions. Now, getting that work done is difficult because it's dangerous for the contractors to get around Iraq, and the insurgents target, you know, signs of progress like water treatment plants that have come online. And, you know, there are many problems still in Iraq that need to be addressed, and we certainly write about them, and that's one of the reasons we get a lot of criticism.
There was a shift of a sort of big shift of money away from civil projects to fighting the insurgents. Has there been any kind of a shift of that money back to improving the electricity and the sewage and the water?
Yeah, there's still money being spent on electrical projects and water projects. But I think the idea was that we were spending so much money on these civilian projects and they were getting attacked. And so that money was just being wasted. And the idea was if you can resolve the insurgency problem or at least minimize it, then you can start rebuilding again. But rebuilding never stopped. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still going on and it has continued to go on, you know, since 2003.
I don't know if during the few days that you've been back in the United States since your own time there, you've spent much time watching television or reading newspapers or magazines, but it's kind of an interesting perspective that you have, having been in that country for 9 months, sending the stories out to be now living in America and seeing where they are in the newspaper and how people are reacting to them. Are you surprised by anything that you're seeing?
I'm surprised at how much people still care about Iraq here. You know, when you're in the middle of the story and you're living and breathing it day after day and it's so important to you, you know, you wonder sometimes whether or not it's resonating, you know, so many thousands of miles away. And so I guess I'm surprised that Iraq is still at the top of the agenda here. You know, I was somewhat surprised by that.
And a little encouraged, I suspect.
And encouraged, exactly, that all that work and all those risks were not taken in vain.
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri, and Paul's joining us on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I'm curious how being a female affects her performance in a Muslim country and with the U.S. soldiers in a very dangerous combat situation.
Well, actually, being a woman, I found to be an asset because unlike my male colleagues, when I wanted to go out and report on the streets, I could put on a headscarf and wear the traditional abaya, the long black dress, and as long as I monitored, you know, some of my American Americanisms, I could pass for an Iraqi, and I could go pretty much undetected through the markets, and nobody paid any attention to me. The military, you know, I found to be, you know, very accommodating for me as a woman. I mean, there were certainly physical challenges, not in terms of me keeping up, but there are just things that you don't think about when you know you're going to be in a Humvee for 12 hours. And, you know, you have to dehydrate yourself, and these sorts of things were challenges. But I actually found it to be an asset.
When you slip on the abaya and a headscarf, are you at all raising the risk for yourself if you're then found out to be an American in, you know, well, I'll say in disguise, out to get the story? Would there be perhaps greater retribution against you for that risk?
I don't know. I mean, I thought about that a lot. I mean, I certainly I had an incident in back in June when I was outside of Abu Ghraib prison, and I was wearing a scarf and an abaya, and there were two individuals that tried to kidnap me, and when they discovered I was an American, they ripped my abaya off and saw I was wearing a flak jacket, and immediately started saying CIA, CIA. They thought that, you know, I was posing, and I think that's the greater risk, is not that they'll find out that you're an American reporter, but they'll think that you're somehow working for the American intelligence.
And you don't really have a whole lot of time under circumstances like that to say, let's stop and talk about this.
No, exactly. There's not a lot of dialogue that's taking place. But I think the idea is simply to be obscure, and the more obscure you are, the more safe you are.
Do you work scared most of the time in a place like that?
You know, it comes and goes. You know, I think it was far more difficult for my family because they didn't know when I was feeling scared and when I was feeling safe. And so they worried 24 hours a day about what I was going through. And, you know, there were definitely moments when I was terrified. And there were days where, you know, my main goal was simply to stay alive till the end of the day. And I thought about, you know, dying a lot. And I thought about the risks that I was taking quite a bit. But there were also moments of great joy. I called them my oases of joy when, you know, we were having, you know, dinner and you know, you forgot that you were in Iraq and interacting with the staff, you know, who became my family over that time period, and, you know, playing soccer in the backyard of our house and shooting basketball, you know, with the cooks and you know, singing Frank Sinatra with, you know, with some of our staff. I mean, those were moments where I definitely wasn't scared.
I'm wondering if you also develop a kind of a passion for the country, or a desire to see, you know, whatever is to be for the country, at least give them some kind of respite from what they've all been through.
You do, and I definitely have developed, I would say, a love for Iraq and for the Iraqi people. I don't think it affects my objectivity in any way, but I do believe that I feel connected to the country, and I feel connected to the struggle. And, you know, I'm very curious and anxious to see what's going to happen to Iraq. And I want Iraq, you know, to be a safe country. And I want people to be happy and to, you know, have some of the things that we have in the U.S. And, you know, and that's not making a statement about how they're going to get there. But you do. You spend that much time in a place and you struggle with it. And you do. You fall in love with it.
Can you put into words where that comes from? Because most people who get their news in radio newscasts about, you know, today's car bombing and yesterday's explosion at the mosque are also pretty conflicted about the number of nasty people in that country and how anybody could. I mean, there becomes a sort of plague on everybody attitude, I think, as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely bad people in Iraq, and you know, and after a while, you know, you wonder who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. I mean, I've noticed back in the U.S., one of the things that I'm working through in terms of my experience is not looking at every car and wondering if it's going to blow up next to me on I-95. And, you know, you do, and then the Iraqi people themselves are, I think, conflicted about their country. Many of the elite are leaving. They've given up on Iraq, and I find that to be very sad.
I remember there was a neighborhood in Jordan that was in Amman, Jordan, that was all being built up, sort of clouds of construction dust all over the place. And a taxi driver pointed to it and said, that's where the Iraqis are all moving to. Did you see the same sort of thing when you were transiting through Amman?
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of Iraqis in Jordan. There are many Iraqis in Syria. And, you know, I know many of our staff are wondering, you know, how long they're going to stay in the country, because they know that there's no quick fix and that this violence is not going to go away overnight. And they're worried about their families and they're worried about their own safety. And you wonder, once things are resolved, how many of the sort of the intellectual elite, the artists, the doctors, you know, the movers and shakers are actually going to be left in the country.
So what's your what are the markers then that you'll be watching, Jackie, whether you're here or back on assignment in Iraq, to see if it's going to work, if the people will in fact gain some kind of control over their own insurgency, some kind of handle on their own political affairs? Is it just watching what happens at the National Assembly, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's much more complicated than that. I think it's, you know, in order for people to feel that they have a stake in the government, they have to feel safe. And, you know, the bottom line for most of the Iraqis that I talk to is the political process to them is irrelevant if they can't send their children to school, if they can't go to the market, and they can't drive down the highway without wondering if they're going to make it to their destination. So the thing that I'm going to be looking for is definitely, you know, the number of attacks, if they go down, when American troops stop dying. Those are all going to be factors for me that say that progress is on its way. For me, it's not really even the political process, because that's not, at the end of the day, that's not what people are thinking about. They're thinking about their safety.
And when politicians and people in this country imagine the beginning of the U.S. troop withdrawal in 6 months or 9 months or 12 months or whatever it is they're talking about, what do you think?
Well, I think that most of the Iraqis that I talk to recognize that while they do not like the occupying forces, they recognize that if the Americans left, there would be a disaster. And the American military commanders recognize this, and the people recognize this. Even the Sunni extremists who were against the war and are against the American occupation, when you get down and talk to them, they know that they can't go away.
Jackie, it's good to have you back in one piece. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Jackie Spinner, reporter for The Washington Post, just back from 9 months in Iraq. Earlier in the program, a few words with Alyssa Rubin, who is one of the Baghdad bureau chiefs for the Los Angeles Times. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Pamela Ferdinand, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.